We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Charlie Brennan along with Alex Kotlowitz, who I spoke with 27 years ago when he wrote There Are No Children Here. That was a runaway New York Times bestseller about two young boys growing up in Chicago. In fact, my wife featured it in her book club, so we have a family connection to that book. And it later became one of the 150 most important books of the 20th century, according to the New York Public Library, an award-winning book. Alex Kotlowitz on this edition of Profiles.
Welcome to Profiles. From entertainers to athletes, political leaders to entrepreneurs, Profiles gives you an insight into what has made these unique personalities who and what they are today. Now, Profiles on St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
So, when I found out that Alex Kotlowitz had written another book about Chicago, this time, An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago, taking us back to a very violent summer, 2013, I said, I gotta talk to this guy, and here you are, Alex Kotlowitz. Welcome back to KMOX.
Well, Charlie, thanks. It's been a while.
It's been too long. Kevin Horrigan, who was my co-host at the time, and I interviewed you, and at that time we followed Pharaoh and
Lafayette.
And Lafayette, yeah. And Pharaoh is in your book.
He is, yeah. Mm-hmm. He's in the prelude to this book. In some ways, it was kind of partly, I mean, not, you know, among others, but his experience partly kind of pushed me towards writing this book.
I want to talk about him, but first let's kind of talk about violence in general, because St. Louis, unfortunately, can relate, as can East St. Louis. Between 1990 and 2010, about 14,000 people killed in Chicago, 60,000 wounded. Of course, that's far beyond the number we lost in Afghanistan and in Iraq. When you took a look at Chicago in 2013 for those 3 months, 172 people killed, almost 800 wounded. Now, those are staggering numbers, but since you've been following this for almost 30 years, have you been desensitized to the violence?
No, and I think that's kind of the myth, is that, you know, people who live in these communities get desensitized or hardened to it or numb to it. And in fact, you know, the violence, it gets in your bones. I mean, it comes to shape you, and you work really hard not to let it define you. And that's clear in all the stories in this book, each of whom in some manner or another has been touched by the violence.
14 stories in this book.
Right. Yeah. So the book is, it's told over the course of the scaffolding for the book is this one summer, which actually was a reasonably good summer by Chicago standards. And each of the stories are of people who in one manner or another have been touched by the violence, you know, from victims to perpetrators to friends. And I was looking for stories that upended me, that upended my thinking, that sort of knocked me off balance. And I think and I hope that each of these stories in some way or another will surprise readers as well.
Well, I'm glad you did, because, you know, in our newspaper, the Post-Dispatch, which probably covers homicides more thoroughly than others, most of these are in the small agate type under the Law and Order Digest.
Right. And in fact, one of the things that, and I suspect this is probably the case in St. Louis, but certainly in Chicago, is often, more often than not, when somebody is killed in the city, they're described as a gang member, described by their criminal background. And there's one story in the book, early story of a young man who is killed, and his mother, the first thing she does, he's a victim, and yet the headline reads, you know, convicted felon shot and killed in the South Side. And she does everything she can to make sure that she understand people. She's not in denial, but she wants people to understand there was more to her son than what has been acknowledged.
That's Lisa Daniels.
Lisa Daniels, right. And in fact, she gets her a frame for her license plate, which reads, he was my son, his name was Darren. Of course, the other part of her story, which is incredibly remarkable, is she comes to forgive the person who shot and killed her son.
That's pretty staggering, because she was asked to give a victim witness statement at the sentencing, and she asked for leniency.
She asked for leniency, and then she begins a correspondence with him. And she, you know, she comes to realize that, you know, she's been out there defending the honor of her son, who's been killed in this drug deal gone wrong. And she realizes that if she's going to defend the honor of her son, that he shouldn't be defined by this one moment. She needs to do the same for the person who shot and killed him. And she also recognizes how that line between victim and perpetrator is often so blurred. And so she comes to forgive him.
Alex, how do these kids stray and become involved in gun violence?
So there's a story in my book for me which sort of speaks to that, and it's the story of Marcelo Sanchez. You know, this young, he's growing up in the Southwest Side. He's a member of a gang, and yet he's also a straight A student at a top parochial school. In fact, all his friends would call him the stupid smart kid. Which was about right. And Marcelo, at the age of 16, gets shot in both legs, and he realizes that the only way he's going to be able to move on is to physically remove himself from his neighborhood, which is really not an option for most of these kids. And he gets himself into this jewel of an institution in the city, Mercy Home for Boys and Girls, and is doing incredibly well. And then at the end of his junior year, he goes home one weekend and hooks up with some friends, and they end up going out and robbing three people of their cell phones. And it's pretty violent. And there are no weapons involved, but they punch, you know, they beat some of the couple of people up, and he's arrested and charged with a felony. And it's a story about walking this tightrope, about sort of trying to find your way, trying to navigate your way through this. And Marcelo, one of the things that's clear that makes a difference in Marcelo's life is these adults enter his life who make such a difference for him.
For the good or for the bad?
For the good. These adults, yeah. These adults come in and they offer some direction, some guidance. They, again, you know, this is a theme that I saw in so many of the stories that I landed on, is this notion of forgiveness. And for Marcelo, he's trying to find a way to forgive himself for what he did. He's incredibly remorseful about that incident.
Oh, I'm a little confused. Do these boys, and they're mostly boys, I'm sure that's true in Chicago, not because it's true here in St. Louis. The crime is largely committed by the young men.
Right.
Do their mothers have moral compasses? Are their fathers involved? How do they end up shooting each other?
Yeah. I mean, here's the bottom line is that you look at all the violence in Chicago, St. Louis, Philadelphia, New Orleans, any of our cities, and the commonality they all have is that they all occur in neighborhoods that are deeply distressed, in which that kind of window of opportunity is not only not widened, but it's narrowed. And so this kind of resentment builds up, this sense of anger. You know, people are looking for some self-worth, some kind of self-respect. And one of the ways they find it is sort of by their sort of being in charge, you know. And given the accessibility of guns, often these disputes, which turn into something considerably worse. And it's not so much that people don't have moral compasses. I mean, one of the things that I found in many of the people I spoke with is they so deeply regretted this one moment where they just simply went off. And it's not in many ways, I mean, again, it's not unlike what we see in veterans returning from combat, you know, in Iraq and Afghanistan, who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, who get angry really easily. They have trouble sleeping. They self-medicate. You see that the same in these young men. And so they get easily, easily agitated.
You also point out, though, I think with Marcelo, that there is a high, perversely as that sounds, there's a high associated with these attacks.
Right. So when he goes off on these kids, there's a kind of adrenaline. In fact, there's another story of a kid who after he loses his best friend, punches somebody, and he suddenly feels a sense of relief. And again, it has to do with this kind of high level of agitation, this anger, this resentment that builds up. Marcelo now, I will tell you, I'm not going to give too much away, but he's not the same person he was when he was 17. He's about to graduate from college. And that his story is not an unusual one, except that he really was able to get some assistance at Mercy Home.
Being in Chicago with the high homicide rates recently, isn't there a temptation to compare and contrast with New York, where the homicides, right, for some reason, Alex, seem to, right, have gone way, way down?
Right. So New York is the aberration. New York is the one, New York and L.A. now, but these two cities in which we've seen the violence really diminish over the years. And there are various explanations for it. In New York, for example, one is that, you know, it's a city that's become incredibly gentrified. It's really pushed the poor out of the city. There's been a real concerted effort on the part of the local government there to sort of view violence as a matter of public health, and they've created all these violence prevention programs in the city. The other thing about New York, I grew up there, so I'm familiar with the city, is unlike Chicago or St. Louis, it's not so deeply segregated. People are kind of living on top of each other. And one of the commonalities in these cities that experience this high levels of violence is this kind of hyper segregation that exists.
Mm. Yeah. Dense areas of African-Americans who are poor.
Completely isolated from the rest of the city, physically and spiritually.
Well, that's the case in St. Louis, and that is the case in Chicago as well?
It is. Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, you do point out at the very beginning of the book, if we're looking for policy answers, don't expect them in your brand new book, An American Summer.
Right. I'm really straight about this at the very beginning that, first of all, public policy is not my bailiwick. I have strong opinions. I'm a storyteller. And the reason I tell stories is not to answer questions, but to ask them. And that's what I hope this book does. I mean, one of the things that was clear to me in the wake of the shootings at Parkland and Newtown, we were asking all the right questions. You know, how does a community and these individuals move on after bearing this weight of this tragedy? We don't ask those questions in these corners of Chicago or St. Louis.
Alex Kotlowitz has written An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. We'll come back in a moment on The Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now back to Profiles on St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
Alex Kotlowitz is with us today. His new book, An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. Charlie Brennan with you. And you were talking earlier about Columbine and Newtown and Parkland. And you're right. That's when we concentrate on the homicides. Sly James, the mayor of Kansas City, has said, we've got those. They're just in slow motion. They take place over a long period of time. And I find that most people don't seem to be too concerned about the homicides that are going on. At least it's not expressed, the urban violence. We don't express the navel gazing, the self-examination, the questions with the experts like we do with the school shootings or the office shootings.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, for me, that was really what brought me to write this book, is this utter kind of neglect, this kind of capacity to turn our heads from what's going on in these neighborhoods. And so what I try to do in this book is really put a human face on the people in these neighborhoods and what they're experiencing. And again, I do think there's this kind of myth out there that, you know, all this violence is occurring and people are just sort of moving on with their lives without any regard for what's happened, when in fact, nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, they are suffering and struggling in all the same ways that the individuals are in the wake of the mass shootings at Parkland or Newtown or Columbine. And I saw that in all the people that I spent time with.
You know, we talk about the homicides, which are tragic. We often don't talk about the shootings where people are wounded. Right. And sometimes they end up in a wheelchair for the rest, right, of their life. And you know what? They get even less attention than the urban homicide.
Right, right. And there's a story, just a very short piece in my book, about this young man who is shot and he's a quadriplegic. He's, you know, has no movement of any of his limbs, and he doesn't have a place to live. He can't live with his mom because she doesn't have the facilities for him. So and this is not an unusual story in Chicago. He lives in a nursing home, actually lives on a dementia floor, and can't get out of bed, and that's his life. I just saw him a couple of weeks ago, and there's this amazing kind of tranquility about him, that this is sort of just his fate. But there's so many others like him for whom we don't have the capacity to care for them.
Are you sure it's not depression disguised as tranquility?
Well, listen, I suspect there's got to be some depression there. I have no doubt about it. But yeah. But he's also kind of the mind that he, and you know, you see this in people, again, it's been, you know, 10 or 12 years since he was shot, maybe even longer, but a sense, you know, that maybe I kind of got what I deserved, and, you know, the sort of blaming himself for where he's at.
How about the moms? I think we talked about Lisa Daniels in the previous segment. She lost her son. Did she tell you that she kind of went from skirts and high heels to jogging pants and sneakers?
Right. That was another mother who told me that.
Oh, another one.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, listen, I mean, the mothers are the ones, of course, who grieve the hardest. I mean, it's that pain, that sorrow. I can't even imagine of losing a son or a child to the violence. It's just got to eat away at you. And I saw that in all these moms. You know, some of them would hold on to them. One of them got a tattoo of the last EKG of their son right before they passed on her forearm. You know, another mother I met had a life-size cardboard cutout of her son in her living room. Another still holds on to the clothes that their daughter was wearing when she was shot and killed. So for their mothers, I mean, but the other thing that's remarkable about it is that there are all these organizations in Chicago of these mothers who have lost children. I mean, this speaks to the ubiquitousness of the violence, but all these organizations of mothers who have lost children who kind of support each other. You know, they'll go to each other's trials. They'll show up at birthday celebrations of the deceased. They'll help in trying to leaflet and trying to find the murderer, and it's just these mothers who've kind of created the support group, and there's almost a kind of richness in the mourning.
Do we think that this violence in these communities thwarts academic progress?
Well, I mean, a couple of things. One, let me back up and say one of the things that's clear to me about the violence is it precludes any real and rational conversation about poverty and race in this country. But there's no question that for those kids who've been exposed to the violence, it makes it extraordinarily difficult for them to concentrate. And they come into that school building. And I do think, again, there's this myth about our public schools. While they may not be working as they should, they are places where kids want to go. And they find refuge there. But it's not like they leave behind everything, you know, when they enter that school building in the morning, that they leave everything else that's bearing down on them.
And how could you?
Yeah, and so it's extraordinarily difficult for them to concentrate.
We have an alderman here who recently proposed that the National Guard patrol his ward, and the reason for that, he said that he had a constituent who said an adult, was afraid to take out the garbage.
Right.
Was that afraid of the violence in the neighborhood? Now, if that's how the adults feel, imagine how the kids feel. And you can't tell me that walking into a classroom, it's all going to go away. In fact, in that school setting, I believe you write that the high school counselors who talk to these kids end up needing counseling themselves.
Right. I mean, there's a story in the book about a social worker and a young man, Thomas, who's kind of the zealot of violence in his community. I mean, he's just witnessed so much. At the age of 10, he's at a surprise birthday party, and the birthday girl is shot by a bullet that comes through the window and killed. And then at the age of 17, he's on a porch with his best friend, a girl a year younger than him, and somebody walks out of there, runs out of the gangway, turns around, starts shooting, and ends up shooting Shikaki, this girl, and Thomas is with her as she's dying on the porch. And, you know, Thomas is just this really kind of remarkable kid. I mean, he can't focus, he can't concentrate, he's really angry. And I met him because he would go in, he had a really close relationship with a social worker at his school who just really cared for him, who provided some sort of respite, some sort of succor, and was able to sort of pull and stayed with him. And it's the story is about this kind of beautiful relationship that exists between this social worker and this kid that goes well beyond Thomas's graduation from high school, and Anita ends up leaving the high school as well. But for me, one of the crimes about our public schools is we don't have enough social workers in our schools. We've put too much of a burden on our teachers to deal with this trauma that these kids bring into the building every day.
Our guest is Alex Kotlowitz. He has written a brand new book. It's called An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. Charlie Brennan on KMOX will be back with more in just a moment.
Now back to Profiles on St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
Our guest is Alex Kotlowitz. His new book is called An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. What a great town. And yet, all that glitters is not gold, because just like St. Louis, you know, we've got downtown and the Arch and looks nice and all that, but then not too far away, in fact, within the shadow of the Arch, you can find very violent neighborhoods. In Chicago's case, 14,000 people killed between 1990 and 2010. Of course, that exceeds the number we lost in Afghanistan and Iraq. In the 3 months that Mr. Kotlowitz looked at Chicago, 172 were killed. That's almost as many as we had in St. Louis last year. Of course, our population is smaller. I believe 190 people were tragically killed in St. Louis in 2018, but 800 wounded. And you can imagine. Now, okay, a couple of things here. Do the young men who perpetrate this violence generally have a father in their life?
Yeah. You know, many of them don't, but some do. And in fact, a couple of the stories I do, they had a father. And I'm not sure, you know, there's this kind of, again, this kind of myth that, you know, there was this effort, I remember, under the second President Bush, to this idea that if we could get people married, we come somehow get people out of poverty. But I'm not convinced that, I mean, families have all different, comes in all different shapes and forms. And so I'm not, I mean, it'd be great if you had a father there. I'm not sure that that explains what is going on in these communities. And often the reason we don't have fathers there is because, again, we're, you know, we have, over the past 25 years, we've incarcerated people for really small offenses, and taking people out of their neighborhoods, and have made it really difficult for them to find their footing once they return.
Well, Jason DeParle of the New York Times has looked at marriage and seems to suggest in his writing that there is a connection between marriage and getting out of poverty.
Right, right.
And New York Times is not one of our conservative think tanks, generally speaking.
Right, right.
If you just think, okay, there might be two breadwinners,
right,
that's better than one.
Yeah. Listen, and I know Jason well. He's a friend. Yeah.
I've never met the guy.
Yeah. And you know, listen, all things considered, listen, you know, a two-parent family is the best. I mean, they have both a mother and a father who not only care for you, but, as you say, can provide income for, you know, food, shelter, and clothing. I mean, that's wonderful, but we don't all, you know, not all are so fortunate. And I guess what I'm saying is I'm not quite sure that's an explanation for it. And if, in fact, what we want to do is try to rebuild and fortify families, then we need to figure out ways to rebuild and fortify community, because we're not going to force people to stay together. That's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to ask the question, so what's going on? Where are all these men?
Is it possible that some of the young men are bitter because they live in a society where they see some kids, maybe at high school or whatever, with fathers, and they have fathers who are out of their lives?
Yeah, I think it's more to what you alluded to earlier, which is you walk out of your house in Englewood on the south side of Chicago, and you look at that downtown, at that gleaming skyline. I think probably the most beautiful downtown in the world, with all apologies to St. Louis.
No, I totally agree. It's world class.
Yeah.
It's up there with Paris.
But you look at that and you realize what's not yours.
Yeah.
You realize what's out of your reach. And you, as a result, become resentful and angry. You know, there was this guy years ago, Paul Collier, who was a part of the World Bank, and he was British, and then he wrote a book called The Bottom Billion, this really brilliant book about the developing world. And what he found in communities, in countries in which it was poverty across the board, like Chad, there was very little violence. But it was, the violence occurred in countries in which there were great disparities of income, where you had this sense of resentment, you had a sense of knowing what's not yours. And he comes to Chicago 7-8 years ago, and he thinks to himself, this is it. This is what I saw in the developing world, you know, this incredible disparity of income, this building resentment and anger.
How about your town of Chicago during the days of Al Capone? Mm-hmm. Did the gangster deaths then exceed or reach the number of deaths we have now?
No, it wasn't. I mean, it was bad, but it was also very directed, right? It was all around prohibition. It was all around the liquor trade, for the most part. And I will say the violence has changed in Chicago. You know, when I wrote There Are No Children Here, when I spoke to you 28 years ago, you know, the African-American gangs were all organized. They were very hierarchical, organized around the drug trade. And I remember when I was spending time in the projects and there was about to be a shooting, we'd actually get a warning. You could take cover. And in the late 90s, they, you know, ended up arresting. They went after the head of the snake and they arrested all these gang leaders, and the unintended consequence of that is all these gangs broke apart, and now you have 600 to 800, this is what the police estimate, cliques or crews organized block by block, not around the drug trade, and disputes now are often seemingly over reasonably petty stuff. It feels more random. So the texture of the violence has changed.
Are you seeing carjackings in Chicago like we are here in St. Louis?
Some, yeah. But not a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, we seem to have too many, almost one a day. Also, when you take a look at the city of Chicago, you have to look at drugs. Does addiction play a role?
Yeah, it's not the drug trade really drove the violence 28 years ago. It doesn't now.
Not so much now. No. Yeah. Mm-mm. We need to take another break here. We'll come back with more. Our guest has written An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. Alex Kotlowitz is our guest today on The Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now back to Profiles on St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
Charlie Brennan on The Voice of St. Louis with Alex Kotlowitz, who's written An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. I think it's been out a month or so, and I haven't followed the book sales or anything. How you doing?
Good. It's doing well. I mean, I've just been on a—I mean, I've been traveling across the country over the past 3 weeks, so I'm a little tired, but it's going well. I mean, what I love to do is, you know, spend time in places like St. Louis, cities like, I mean, I could have written this book in so many different places, and so to have this conversation in all these other cities that are experiencing exactly what I see in Chicago.
Did Oprah turn your first book into a movie of sorts?
She did. It was her first made-for-TV movie, Called Their Honor Children Here. She actually starred in it. She played the mom, and Maya Angelou played the grandmother.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Maya Angelou grew up right around the corner from here. Two of the all-time greats. Well, let's hope that Oprah picks up a copy of this book.
Yes,
huh? Yeah, absolutely.
We hope.
You know, you also take a look at an overnight reporter who just can't take it anymore. And I feel that way myself at times, living through Ferguson, and which actually had very little violence, one tragic death.
Right.
After that, no others. But there are times, Alex, when I keep learning about all these senseless deaths in St. Louis, and I feel, I don't know if I can take it anymore. I might have to move to Salt Lake City or Boise or something. I'm serious.
Right. No, it does get in your bones. I mean, I felt it myself. You know, I was reporting this book over the course of 5 years, and in the middle of that, I, you know, entered this kind of dark place.
Did you?
Kind of depressed. Yeah. And, you know, this kind of secondary trauma. I mean, you mentioned that and how the social workers, for example, experience that kind of secondary or visceral trauma. And I certainly experienced it as well. And given what I've experienced, I can only imagine what those I've spent time with experienced in these communities.
You mentioned the lower homicide rates in New York and Los Angeles. They do have at least one thing in common, and that is that Bill Bratton ended up becoming the police chief for both.
Right.
Any connection there, you think?
No, listen, I want to be clear. I think one of the mistakes we've made over the years is thinking that this is solely a police or law enforcement issue. And it's not to say the police aren't part of the problem, but it's so much more than that. And if we make the mistake of just thinking that it's a police issue, we'll never be able to solve this. We'll never get out of this.
And there are some strategies that you've criticized, including some from Senator Kirk.
Right. And so at one point, one of the chapters in the book, it's in one moment when I deal with public policy. So our junior senator, the Republican Senator Kirk, it was on the heels of, you may remember when Hadiya Pendleton, this high school girl who had performed in Obama's second inauguration, she's out with some of her friends, and they some gang members mistake them for rivals and end up shooting into a crowd and end up shooting and killing Hadiya. And the city, and I mean, it was national, international news, and the city was just in utter distress. And in the heels of that, Senator Mark Kirk announces that he wants to arrest all 13,000 gangster disciples, one of the used to be major gangs in the city. And Bobby Rush, who's a congressman from the South Side, and they knew each other because they used to fly back and forth to D.C., invites Mark Kirk to come out and spend a day in his neighborhood. And I managed to finesse my way with them. And they end up running Bobby Rush ended up a party bus. I mean, it was I don't think he quite expected what he got, but it was a small bus with a stripper's pole and a disco light.
Oh, boy.
But anyway, he takes Mark Kirk around for the day. And his effort is to just let Kirk know what the people in his community are up against. I mean, what he really wants to do is sort of understand the kind of stress and distress in his community. And then they go to a gathering of all these people in the community who say, you can't go out and arrest all those people. Those are our brothers, cousins, you know. And it's virtually impossible to grow up in neighborhoods, in certain neighborhoods in the city, and not be affiliated with the gang. And to Kirk's credit, he kind of backed away.
Mm-hmm. But it's gotten to the point, though, where some parents are buying life insurance on their kids, not so much so they can profit from their possible deaths, right, but so that they
can pay their funerals. Yeah.
Really, you see this?
Yeah. Which really, you know, again, speaks volumes to the sort of ubiquity of the violence. I mean, the other thing that's clear, I don't know whether this is in St. Louis, but the warm months come. And of course, when the violence gets worse, is you see all these shrines that appear,
yes,
all over the city, like perennials, you know, the people who are leaving, you know, stuffed animals, liquor bottles, you know, poster boards with signs of love. And it's this kind of like this kind of collective war memorial that's being created in the city.
And you've been in some of the moms' homes where they have memorials.
Right, right.
Yeah. You can't imagine it, and there was once a book by Joseph Wamba, I think, called The Onion Field.
Onion Field, sure, right.
And it did show how a single murder can affect so many lives.
Right.
You think of the mom, but actually there's probably a dozen or so people whose lives are truly diminished by the loss of some person to this violence.
Absolutely. Charlie, I will say, though, that for me, you know, in these 14 stories, the thing I found that for me kept me going is that all these people are somehow standing erect in this world that's slumping around them and moving forward, and some of them moving forward heroically, like Lisa Daniels, or there's a young man, Eddie Bocanegra, who at the age of 17 shoots and kills somebody, and he spends 14 years in prison, and he just wants to find a way to forgive himself for what he's done, and he devotes every ounce of his energy now to try to undo some of the damage that he helped cause. You know, running one of the most inventive violence prevention programs in the city.
How does that work?
So he's done two things. One is he brought war veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan who suffered from PTSD to come mentor young people in the community he works in, and not to talk about their war experience, but to talk about coming home.
Mm-hmm.
And because he wanted those kids, one of the things that was clear in my time, and Eddie saw this as well, is this kind of utter sense of loneliness, a sense that nobody can possibly understand what I've gone through, what I'm experiencing. And he wanted these kids to understand why they were so agitated, why they couldn't sleep at night, why they couldn't concentrate or focus, why they were, you know, smoking a lot of marijuana to self-medicate. And that's what these veterans did, was to help these kids sort of become more self-aware. He's also now has a program that is both providing employment for young men, nothing new about that, but also requiring them to undergo cognitive behavioral therapy. In other words, and again, this effort to make them feel less alone, to connect them to others.
And it seems to be proving useful.
Yeah, I think
useful.
The early indications are that it's actually a program that has some real promise to it.
Well, you know, human interaction generally helps if it's supportive.
Right, and also feeling connected.
I mean,
it also was clear to me that, you know, you kind of experience this violence and you just feel so isolated. You know, one of the books that have stayed with me over the years is Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried.
From Vietnam,
mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, he spent time in Vietnam, and it's a novel, I assume, loosely based on his experience there. And one of the things that's clear to me in that book is just how the violence gets in your bones,
yeah,
and how you're unable, the inability to talk with others about your experience. And that I saw in so many of the people I spent time with.
Yeah, I would think that people would become desensitized, but you dispute that. And in fact, one of your good friends who lived with you, who I think went to Southern Illinois University, saw a tragic killing of a cab driver.
Right.
And when you asked him to relate it later...
Right. So this is Farrow. And so, you know, years ago, he was taking a cab home from our place to his mom's. And when he was getting out of the cab, two men yanked him out of the cab and get in there and put a gun to the cab driver's head to rob him. And the cab driver panics and they end up shooting and killing the cab driver in front of Farrow. And I remember it didn't quite really fully register back then with him. He was without much affect. And I see this a lot. And the mistake is thinking that somehow people don't care. And 20 years later, when I was beginning to work on this book, I sat down with Farrow at a restaurant to talk to him about that experience. And he starts to describe what happened. And at some point, he gets out of our booth and starts crouching. And it's clear. His eyes are wide. He's almost trembling. And it's as if he's back in that moment, living that. And I had to yank him to pull him back into the booth to get him out of that moment.
Really?
I mean, he was kind of having a flashback. And it was in that moment that I just realized how this violence, it just gets in you. It stays with you. It doesn't go anywhere. And he, 20 years, and he had never talked about that experience.
20 years later.
Yeah.
Yeah. Alex Kotlowitz, thank you very much for the hard work you put into An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago, and for sharing it with us. We wish you the best of luck, unless the Cubs or the White Sox are playing the Cardinals.
Charlie, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. It's good to see you again. Yeah.
Great to see you, too. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Profiles. If you missed any of this episode or want to hear other profiles, go to KMOX.com and click On Demand.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.